Thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Rodolfo Anaya, a writer powerfully attuned to the land, history, and people of his native New Mexico. Anaya is often viewed as one of the founders of contemporary Chicano literature. What I've wanted to do, Anaya reflected, is compose the Chicano worldview and clarify it for my community and myself. In doing so, over the course of a remarkable and acclaimed literary career, Anaya redefined the American experience for generations of readers. Today we are joined by Luis Alberto Uria, the editor of a new collection of Anaya's work from the Library of America. Uria is a novelist, short story writer, poet, and the memoirist who is currently Distinguished Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Illinois, Chicago. His most recent works are Goodnight Irene and Zebras in Tijuana. Luis is interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum.
Well, thank you, Luis, for joining me on this episode of Nation of Writers. I am excited to talk to you about Rodolfo Anaya. As I mentioned, I hadn't read him before, but I got the new Library of America collection that you edited. And so I'm reading Vez Mi Ultima now, and fantastic. It's one of those ones, like, I can't believe I hadn't read him before. Didn't know what I was missing out on. But I want to talk a little bit, for our listeners, if you could just talk to us a little bit about yourself and what you've been up to, any sort of projects you got going on.
What have I been up to? Writing. That's what nice. I do, man. That's almost all what I do. Except, you know, what happens to you is writing becomes traveling and becomes talking and becomes researching and then traveling again. So as I was telling you before we started the recording, I just got back from Alaska. Thank God for that. And then, you know, I'm going to have to suffer in November and go to Hawaii. I don't know. It's a burden. Nate, it's just a burden. So, people know me, I think, mostly from three books, I think. The Devil's Highway, nonfiction, Hummingbird's Daughter, and, the last novel that came out, House of Broken Angels. I just wanted to say that the Hummingbird's Daughter was a breakthrough book for me in every way, and it wouldn't exist without Vez Mi Ultima and Rodolfo Anaya.
Wow,
and we can talk about that a little bit, but yeah. You know, I have two books coming out this coming year. One's a small, I like to keep my hands into the small press world and into the Chicano Latino publishing world. I think it's important. Don't forget your roots. So there's a beautiful press that comes out of South Texas, or the Rio Grande Valley, called Flower Song Press. And the guy who runs it is just a wonderful guy. So I have a new book of poetry called Piedra, and Piedra means stone. And so I'm doing it with them, which makes me really happy. And a little Anaya connection, and might help further our theme today, but the epigraph at the beginning of the book is a quote of his: "Ancestors, I fly for you." The other one is my mega novel called Goodnight Irene, and it's a World War II epic based on my mother's World War II experiences. We've been to Europe a whole bunch of times, visiting all the sites. In fact, we went this last summer and walked places she walked, and we went to a village where she was stationed, and the houses that she lived in are still there.
Wow.
You know, it was amazing. So it's been a very rich time.
Yeah.
And the Anaya anthology was a surprise. I think his family wanted me to do it, and they recommended it. At the same time that happened, the new Jim Harrison anthology was being put together of his nonfiction, and they asked me to write that too. So I was kind of, holy God, you know, what's happening? I have to do those things. And they're both such a delight to me. But anyway.
Yeah, that sounds great. You've mentioned the Library of America book, and we should talk about that real quick.
Yeah.
Mentioned it in the, and it's three novels, right? Westmeet Ultima, Tortuga, and
Albuquerque.
Albuquerque, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Some people have been writing and saying, "Oh, God, I can't believe you misspelled it." Say, "No. That's the title of the book."
Yeah. Did they not read your introduction? You talk about it in there, and you mentioned a little bit in the introduction as well about the choice of those three novels. And right. So I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that editing process and sort of how you decided on those three.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that this Library of America volume is really wonderful because I think a lot of readers who aren't specifically Chicano, but who aren't Southwestern or Western readers might not know him, which is hard for me to comprehend, not because of the culture, but a couple of things. Rudy surged at the time of the kind of Chicano efflorescence in the early 70s, right? And we came out of a do-it-yourself. It was almost punk rock, you know, because it was a do-it-yourself culture where the writers and the poets and even the graphic artists and the playwrights didn't feel like they had access to the New York publishing. New York had no idea, and they still kind of don't. What's out there in the West? What is that? And so it was not rare to have publishing companies sprout out of someone's garage or, you know, a community center or whatever. And so there was this press on the West Coast, Quinto Sol, Tonatio Quinto Sol, and they published Chicano writers, and they created a writing award, and Rudy was the first to win the award for Bless Me Ultima. And they published it in a paperback original. And, you know, we all always who did things with those small backyard presses expected a couple of hundred books. And he ended up selling 300,000 copies.
Wow. 300,000. Wow.
300,000 at when the last numbers I ever saw from those guys. But, you know, it was a phenomenon. And, I told you earlier, before I think we were recording, that I could not have written Hummingbird's Daughter without Bless Me Ultima. So when the request came to do this, to kind of make sense of this collection, and, you know, I mean, they are being incredibly generous saying I was the editor, because, you know, I'm not editing his work, but I'm trying to make a point of how these works go together and make sure the bibliography is worthy of some scholarship, that kind of thing. I wouldn't dare touch Rudy's words. So Bless Me Ultima begins this amazing career, which in some ways contains a terrible challenge. And that was, and Rudy and I talked about this many times, what do you do when your first book is legendary and huge?
Yeah. Where do you go next?
And I think though he was kind of a shaman, you know, call him shaman of words and things. You know, he had other interests too. And he was uproarious and he was fun and he was funny. And that book is funny and funky and all that too. So I think that kind of pushed him in weird directions, and the expectations on him were so high. And, you know, later in his career, he wrote a series of detective novels. Why the hell not? Right? Tony Fillerman-esque, except, you know, in these books, the detective could occasionally levitate into the sky and do soul battle with an evil wizard, you know. He was just trying everything because he wanted to and he could. So I think that's the milieu in which you find Anaya functioning.
Yeah, I like that you just describing his, that sort of his nature of, you know, trying different things, you know, being fun, uproarious, said like that. Just as I'm reading Blessed Be Ultima, that makes me think of the Marez side, yeah, of that, side of the family, kind of that the pull to always go somewhere.
Yeah.
Like the pull of the sea. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's inescapable. It's there in some sense, it's universal, you know, and a lot of us who have Latine, I guess is the term this month that we use, roots or culture, whether it's Mexican or South American, you know, there's this thread that seems to go through our cultural DNA. You know, the elder woman who is a receptacle of mystery and power, you know, the indigenous shadow, the funkiness, it's always kind of funky, you know, and the humor and the folkways, it's very earthy. You know, I was really super blessed. Ingrid Contreras, kind of, you know, really the man who could move clouds. It's, you know, it's up for big awards all of a sudden. But she sent it to me thinking that because of Hummingbird's Daughter, I might understand it, because it's a book about, a nonfiction book about unbelievable things, curanderos and magic and all this stuff. And I knew immediately, because it was a Rudy Anaya kind of vibe, and the things that I had been raised with too. So, you know, I think, and it's important for, I didn't really get to talk about this in the intro because you're trying to be sort of scholarly and I was already pushing it with personal detail and so forth. But a couple of things that are pertinent to what we're talking about. You know, Rudy took care of a lot of people. He maintained a beautiful cabin in the mountains that people could go stay at and write. You know, when Jimmy Santiago Baca's ranch burned down, Rudy went there and helped them. There's a little vignette, I think, in the introduction of this book that talks about me. I was camping out and a tornado destroyed the campground.
Yeah.
And he called me there at about midnight. Get back down to Albuquerque, and I went down there, and he was waiting in his pajamas.
Yeah, and, I love that little vignette in there. And he's like, I told you to stay here.
I told you to stay at my house.
Yeah.
I was too humble. I thought, I took him up on it. And, you know, just so you know, I mean, we stayed in touch till the end. And the last time he wrote to me, I saved the envelope. He wrote on the front, "Nobody writes to Anaya." And I thought, oh man, he's guilting me, you know. So that's, it was funny. Just a wonderful friendship and a mentorship. And the last thing I want to say, and then, you know, whatever questions you may have about this, was when I was coming up as a writer, just so you know, I thought it was hopeless. I thought there was no way I would do it. I just needed to do it. You know, and I had two mentors. The first was Ursula Le Guin.
Mm.
The second was Rudolfo Anaya. And
pretty good company.
No kidding. I mean, talk about charting a course, you know.
Yeah.
So I feel answerable to them. I don't know if you remember the Bloomsbury Review. Remember that? The book newspaper that came, it was like the Rolling Stone of literature, kind of. They ceased publication, unfortunately, but at some point they published a piece that said that Rudy and I were the alpha and omega of Chicano literature. And I was like, I have arrived.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, I want to put that on a t-shirt.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah, you mentioned it a little bit. I'm curious how how your friendship with Rudy started, and you've I mean, not even alluded to it, said he was a huge influence on you as a
yes.
friend and a mentor. So I'm just curious how that friendship started and evolved, and what it's meant to you, you know, in all aspects of your life.
Right. I'd like to say, well, you know, in meditation, I teleported, but no.
Yeah.
It's more practical than that. I met Le Guin in my senior year of college. After I graduated from college, I got a job at a community college in San Diego in the Chicano Studies Department as a bilingual tutor and so forth. And the man who ran it was a brilliant, brilliant scholar, poet, Jesuit named Cesar Gonzalez. And he was a super expert on Chicano literature, which I wasn't. I wasn't. And so I went to work with him, and he had written the first completely bilingual community college English textbook.
Oh, wow.
Which was super cool.
Yeah.
And because it was a Chicano studies program, he had gone to all the major Chicano authors and had them write messages and, you know, excerpts for the book. And he was very close to one of our greatest scholars, Don Luis Lea. And they were introduced, and he and Rudy became friends. And so Rudy was coming to San Diego on book tour. And bless his heart, Cesar sent me to meet him at the airport.
Oh, wow.
And I was just, wow, you know, amazing. I went with a friend. We picked Rudy up. And I didn't realize this trickster thing. You know, Rudy was very sly. And he said, I'm very hungry. Can we go out? Yes. So he took him to a restaurant. And he said to the waiter, do you have fresh fruit? They said, yes. Oh, thank you. I'd love a little bowl of fresh fruit. And then he says to us, because we were Southern California idiots, you know, I come from New Mexico and it's desert. I've never had fresh fruit. We're like, oh, my God, really? You know, so he was often laughing at our expense. And the book, Heart of Aztlan, which I mentioned in the introduction of, it was part of this trilogy, Bless Mi Ultima, Tortuga, and Heart of Aztlan. And he had gotten raked over the coals for it. It wasn't, you know, top-notch Anaya, but he was trying to do a social realism vibe while honoring this tradition he had set in motion. And it got raked over the coals, and a lot of the politicized, as it was getting more political all the time, dialectical criticism in the Chicano movement sort of thing, they trashed it. And he was really stumped. So I'm going to use a bad word, and you might want to bleep it out, but this was a great moment because I was seeing him as the great, you know, the great holy man, the monk, the spiritual giant, right? And we're driving along, and I say to him, Rudy, so what do you say to these people who have trashed Heart of Aztlan for not being political enough? He said, I tell them to fuck off. I was rocked. You know, I was hit by a body blow. I thought, oh my God, the saint just cursed, you know. But I realized so many things with him, I think, were lessons, even when he didn't know it. I think are the best teachers. And, you know, he always pushed on me that all our language is, you know, it is a ritual, and you should measure the blows you know, and if you really want to make a point like he did, boom, break the chains of being Saint Rudy. And it was brilliant, because I thought later on, when I actually faced criticism, I knew exactly what he meant. I hadn't, you know, even published any. And so that started it. And, you know, he remained loyal, and he remained friendly and avuncular. And so I had Aunt Ursula kicking me around, and I had Uncle Rudy kicking me around. And it was a miracle, because I ended up right, I think, vacillating in the mid space back and forth between them. And when I realized that her sort of Taoist view of the universe was not far from Rudy's indigenized view of the universe, which is why I say I couldn't have written Hummingbird's Daughter without him.
So that's how it started. And over the years, for the first time in my life, I got the chance to travel around. You know, I went from hopeless ghetto boy to doing stuff. And so I went to New Mexico and visited him, slept in his house, you know. It was great. And we saw each other quite a bit. And, you know, at that time I mentioned to you about the Alpha and Omega business, the writing conference in Albuquerque put on an Anaya Urrea event where we were to speak and sign together. He was already in ill health, using a cane, you know, feeling old. And you'll love this because this is very much a medicine man little trick. But they set us up in the sculpture garden, big table, all of our books. Well, I had like four books. He had a million. But and he came in, and he had a little straw hat, and he had his cane, and it was very, you know, it was like something out of Basho or Isa or something, like very Japanese moment of wabi-sabi, you know. He came in and received the love, and there was a little bench in the corner in the sun, and he said to me, Luis, I'm going to go sit over there in the corner. And he went and he sat down. He put his hands on top of the cane and bent his head. And for all intents and purposes, we figured he'd gone to sleep, right? And I'm at the table and the people are lined up and they're looking at him and looking at him. And the organizer said, Luis, you got to go wake up Rudy. And I thought, I'm not going to wake him up. Are you crazy? And they said, no, go wake him up. So I went over there. I said, Rudy? And he never looked up. He said, yes. And I said, they're waiting for you over here. We got to sign books. And he said, no, I'm going to sit here and enjoy the sun. This is time for the young man. You go do this.
Wow.
What? Yeah, you know, yeah. I try to live up to that kind of thing in my own career. That's Rudy's influence. So, you know, he's overwhelming in so many ways for me. And I think, you know, I think these books in this trilogy that the Library of America has done are perfect, because Bless Me Ultima, of course, is the big, and even reading it, you know, yeah, it's mystical, but it's pretty funky and full of all kinds of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
Tortuga is my favorite of his books still, because it's based on his own injuries as a boy. He dove into an irrigation canal and broke his neck.
Oh, wow.
And he was put in a full body cast. He could not move for a very long time, and they called him the turtle, Tortuga. So he places Tortuga in a rehab hospital at the foot of Tortuga Mountain. Mm-hmm. And these kids are all locked away. And at night, when there's nobody looking, they creep out of their rooms and have these interesting experiences. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And the last one in this trilogy, and it's kind of a constructed trilogy, is Albuquerque. Yeah. It's not a typo. Albuquerque. Yeah. He maintained that the original name in Spain was spelled that way, and it was simplified because it was hard to say, to Albuquerque. Albuquerque. And I don't have any proof of this, but I write about it in the introduction that I feel that he was so stung by the response to Heart of Aztlan, but he wasn't done with trying to figure that out. Mm. That sort of, what is that next step in our motion from the desert or the mystical past of to this 40s, 50s culture to what at that time, you know, the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. urban new. And I think that was his answer, that he used the things he had learned in his other books and went back to that. So in a way, it's sort of a delayed gratification trilogy.
I like that. I mean?
Yeah. And this is just me talking. I'm skylarking here, pal. But maybe he himself had to make that journey deeper into the new era
Right.
Because I think he often was back in the other place.
Hmm. Yeah. That's interesting. You mentioned just briefly about the notion of like the political writing and not being political enough. And you do mention that that story you just told in that, but I like how you, in the introduction, you write, he responded with a sailor's suggestion of what they could do to themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, you can't have an S-bomb in the library. Yeah.
But then right after that is the quote that you say to every writing group you instruct, it's the quote of personal writing is political writing. He said, if you can take your abuelita in Tijuana and make her the grandmother of someone in Iowa or Nebraska simply through your art, then you have accomplished the most powerful spiritual or political act any person can possibly commit. A great, fantastic approach to writing, great quote and a lot of wisdom in it, but I'm curious how is he able to do that in his writing, do you think? Those sort of like, because as I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm from New Hampshire originally, so up in New England, but
I love New Hampshire, brother.
Yeah.
I live in Massachusetts. I go visit the old man in the mountain up there.
I live right there, that's awesome.
I'm ready.
But so as I'm reading Bless Me Ultima, I've never been to the Llano. I've never been to New Mexico, to the Southwest. My dad grew up in San Diego, so I've been there. I've been to Tijuana, but I found myself being able to see myself there, or at least envision the landscape. And I feel like I know, you know, I feel like I know a lot of the characters, or I can see my, like, I mean, like that quote says, like, I can see my grandmother in Rhode Island, you know, so I'm just curious how he was able to do that. But that might even be like one of those mysteries. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I think he had this faith in inhabiting his prose. And, you know, I don't think he was trying to reach out so much as to tell what was important. To tell the truth, you know, and it that worked. My wife always tells me I have a Jesus complex. I don't know that that's true, but I know I have like a Saint Francis complex in that, you know, you want to say hello to brother sun and sister moon, and you want to have all the birds be your friends, and you want to communicate maybe the peace of God, if that's what it is. I think Rudy was always trying to communicate, because he brought it up all the time, as these kachinas, these spirits that he believed in. And also just to be able to represent, you know, when I'm on tour, no matter where I am, I start out in Spanish.
I love that. Yeah.
You know, I just did Rebecca Mackay's story studio, you know, writing festival. Yeah. And I say, you know, buenas tardes, Chicago, Tijuana in the house. Partially because people dig seeing, you know, Irish looking boy yelling in Spanish, but also it places me and I remind myself who I am, where I come from. And it begins a conversation that's fun. So I think all those things are elements. And I'll tell you, when Anaya strayed from those roots, he often had a hard time of it, because I don't think he was the ancestor. He was the predecessor. And I don't know that the culture had gained enough traction to sit back and say, oh, okay. You know, Ursula, when she was first writing, the science fiction trade wouldn't take women authors seriously, and they made believe they were males.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a thing about being ahead of the cultural curve, and sometimes the culture itself has to catch up to you. That being said, you know, Anaya to young writers seems a little archaic.
Yeah.
It's an older voice. I mean, you know, the materials from Bless Me Ultima are from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and, you know, came out in the early 70s. So I think that's representation. We're still far behind, I think, understanding. I mean, he was gone for all of this, but I always wondered what he would have made of Trump's wall, you know?
I mean, that was one of my questions I always like to ask for these episodes is, you know, if he were alive today, how he would be engaging with our world. And it's a, you know, question that no one really has an answer to, but we can surmise and you knew him well. So, especially in this world we're in now, how do you think he'd be, what would he be up to, you know?
I don't know. You know, he had a very generous heart. And so, you know, he taught for quite a while until he made enough money that he could leave the academy.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, I mean, he was generous with support to other writers. You know, he was formulaic in starting the Blue Mesa Review Journal, which is still publishing. He undertook the evolution of my career when other people wouldn't. For example, he published what turned out to be my most popular short story in Blue Mesa Review. He was the first one to. And you don't know this, but my first book, Across the Wire, a nonfiction book about the garbage pickers in Tijuana and the orphans and stuff, nobody would publish it. It was rejected for 10 years.
Wow.
And I complained to him, and he immediately blurbed it. And then he activated other writers to blurb it.
Wow.
You know, it was amazing, and it got published. So I think if, you know, I don't dare speak for him, but I think now, you know, creeping up on 100 years old or passing that, I don't know. I think he would take his position as the elder, you know, as the former king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if I'd go to his house, it always ended up us in the kitchen. I have the most beloved picture of him sitting at his kitchen table with a glass of wine. And he's like this, you know, with his looking up, talking. He had so much to share.
Hmm. Yeah. And I feel like, I obviously didn't know him, but just from what you're talking about and how, you know, I've met you a couple of times, but it seems like, you know, he might not be around, but his influence on you and others, and then how you are passing that on as well, is that's what keeps it alive, right? That's what keeps that lineage, the literary lineage, and also just the, you know, being a good person, you know,
yes, absolutely. I, you know, like I said, I have both Rudy and Ursula to answer to, and other mentors along the way. And I don't always understand some of the attitude people have, or, you know, some of the weirdness in the writing world. I mean, you see a lot of writers.
Yeah.
Sometimes you think, well, I wish I hadn't met that person. Because I have that elevated view of writers. And I think, oh, such magical people. And I'm not always very careerist. For a long time, I was just so thankful that these folks let me in the clubhouse.
Mm.
I didn't think I'd ever get up there, ever, 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 ever. But I couldn't stop writing. I couldn't not write.
Yeah.
You know, right. And then to have people that were gods to me say, hey, kid, that's good. I thought, whoa. Whether it was or not. Yeah, me? Yeah. Yeah. Right? There was a great cartoonist named Stein. He's forgotten now, but he had a cartoon that just killed me. And it was called "A Reprehensible Dog Can't Accept Affection" or something like that. And it's this scribble of a dog looking back, growling. That was me. I was like, what are you doing? Why? But the secret too is, I would say that Rudy, let's not kid ourselves, obviously had a very strong ego and sense of self, you know. And I would say that, you know, the humblest of shamans out there, bodhisattvas, you know, Buddhism masters, Franciscans, I mean, you know, those people also have a pretty strong ego. Yeah, I love the Jesuits, but those are some pretty, you know, we got it together people. So yeah, I think he had that too. He was very aware that he was Vudianaya.
I like that. Yeah, you mentioned the Bodhisattva in the intro again. You refer to him as he was, in spite of his own denials, the Yano's Bodhisattva.
He was.
Could you like expand on that for our listeners? Like,
sure. I mean, you know, he earlier I mentioned Basho and Issa, the haiku poets. You could have been walking all over Japan with Basho when he did the book, you know, Journey to the Interior, whatever the translations were. And Rudy would have been one of those wise Zen masters sitting in a temple, right? And he would have entered into some kind of karma battle with you, or you know, he would have given you some impossible question. And if you were smart, you'd answer him back with an impossible answer, and he would say, "You've got it."
That's right.
And he sometimes did that, and he loved play. He loved play. I think one of the sad things that have beset our faith habits now as a culture is we don't remember to have fun.
Yeah.
You know, we don't see a smile on what we consider to be the infinite or the sacred very much. Right now it's scowling and pissed off. Wants to kill Democrats, you know. I don't think it's that way. And that's partially, again, you know, not only Rudy, but the way I grew up. I grew up with all these grandmothers. The men, you know, Rudy's interesting, and I want to throw this out to you. He, in some ways, is the other side of a coin in that, and I've said this in other pieces of writing, that in my world, the women, particularly the older women, actually ran the world and the universe, and they allowed the men to strut around like roosters, crowing, digging in the dirt and raising hell, and let them think they were the bosses.
Right.
But they actually carried the tradition. They carried the family history. They carried the lines of secrets. They knew what plant did what. You know, if you had an ear infection, they'd want to, I need to pee in your ear. No. But they knew whatever that was had an ancient provenance, as funky as it seemed. And I think, you know, that's very interesting. It's interesting to me that Rudy chose to try to capture women's power and mystery. It's not lost on me that I had a great aunt who was this great revolutionary leader and allegedly, according to the New York Times, the queen of the Yaqui nation. Yaquis, of course, didn't have a queen, but I understood the point. So I found myself treading a similar path. It wasn't a decision like I'm going to do an Anaya. I needed to tell this story about my elder. He needed to tell a story about his elder, and it was just a magnificent thing that they were two powerful women. There really was an ultima. How much that truth got into this novel, I don't know.
That makes me think too. Right before this is editing a podcast from the American Writers Festival. And I found myself fascinated by their mentioning of the oral storytelling tradition and how important that is. And Joy relayed a story of she would, you know, hide under the table when her mom and her friends were around talking just to listen to the stories. And I know from hearing you talk that that's been important to you as well. Did you see that in Rudy's work as well?
I mean, all three of these books are soaked in it. You might as well have a scratchy recording of people talking. And yeah, I didn't hide under the table, but I hid around the corner.
Yeah.
And my you know, my relatives, all they had was gab, jokes, complaints, boasts, weird history. And you know, the first time I actually went to Mexico, really went, not just Tijuana, which is all I knew. My family was from what I call the real Macondo. It's a town called Rosario. El Rosario, Sinaloa. And I had never, I mean, you know, you grow up in a certain air of magical realism. Part of Rudy's critical problem was that the Latino intellectuals began denying magical realism, partially maybe because of the, you know, tidy little title. But this sprawling sense of the numinous, of the mysterious, of the hilarious, the funky, of the unexpected, of the punchline, it's all together. So my dad took me down the 27-hour bus trip. Wow. This is a very Anaya, and I hate to say it, Garcia Marquez kind of story, in that, you know, my dad wanted me to be more male. I grew up with women. All my besties, except a couple, were girls. He thought, tienes que ser más macho, you know? So he was going to take me down and deliver me to all my crazy male cousins. It was a 27-hour bus trip, and we get on the bus. And he hands me The Godfather, the book, paperback. Read this. And I said, what is this? Just read it. And I spent all 27 hours glued to this book. He didn't want me reading about spaceships and cute little Martian squeaky animals. He wanted me to be a man. And I'll tell you what, when Sonny had his first sexual encounter during the wedding, my eyeballs came out on little springs, you know. So I'm keyed up by The Godfather, and my father's telling me, this is about us. And I said, we're not gangsters. He said, it's not about gangsters, it's about immigrants becoming American. I was like, oh. And then we get down to this place where magic is everywhere. And most of the magic is in all the BS everybody's talking around the clock, and their senses of humor. And it started changing me on the spot immediately. And you know, even modern stuff, I think in the Anaya universe, has elements of ritual and magic to it. I teach, when I teach my writing, and you'll understand this, I think, in a second, but I always teach my students to try to find what I call the understory. That the story itself is on the surface. But if you're a good writer, you'll use words and scenes and feelings and scents and sounds that make a whole huge story under the ground that moves the reader in profound ways that they don't know. That's ritualistic. Stephen King says, in a good story, he has a sub-basement where all the rats and spiders are. That's kind of a version of it. Yeah. So I was there taking all this in. Now, I had always been cataclysmically nearsighted. And my father thought that was a sign of weakness, so he denied it. Nah, he can see perfectly fine. And it was my uncle, the man from the Magic Village, who said, no, he's blind. And my uncle took me to get eyeglasses. And so the first place I really saw was Rosario, Sinaloa.
Wow.
What impact does that have? I think it buried it somewhere deep inside of me, and it radiates constantly. Something that silly. But it was, you know, in another milieu 100 years ago, if you'd put this crystal in front of somebody's face and they could suddenly see, it would be a myth. It would be almost a religious parable.
Yeah.
Which yeah. Garcia Marquez knew when he was writing Papacondo.
I like that's
Rudy,
a great
story. It's Rudy World, man.
Yeah, that's a great story. And I'm glad you mentioned magical realism, too, because in last month's episode of Nation of Writers. It was about Oscar Hijuelos. So it was a conversation about magical realism and kind of about like who gets to call it magical realism, right? Because the magic is real. It's not, you know, it's not, it's very real to like, it was real to Oscar Hijuelos. It wasn't making this up. He had some encounters that were, you know, very spiritual and very unusual, I think was the word that was used. But I was fascinated by that, the conversation of, you know, what is magical realism? And you even say in the introduction, you just flat out say no. It was, what did you say? A trope to capture what the peasant knows deep in her own bones. So to me, it's almost just like a, you know, academic lens put on something that doesn't need to be, you know, academically inspected or tried to rationalize it or anything like that. It is what it is. I don't know.
Absolutely.
Absolutely
true. You can't. Yeah, it's beyond the English department at UIC.
Yeah.
You know, it's beyond a literary critic. And when you try to do that, you know, westernize, if that's even what's happening, intellectualize it, it's more intuitive. There's a wisdom in the intuition that's fascinating and actually quite sophisticated. Somehow we got to Garcia Marquez, but this to me made things super clear. I had this opportunity to tour Colombia. I've been on 3 tours in Colombia, which is the coolest thing ever. And so many people are still afraid of Colombia, but I freaking love it. And with all worries about FARC included, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the first tour, we ended up in Cartagena. And I was losing my mind because I was like, oh, Garcia Marquez, you know. And I went over to the house and I was trying to see over the wall, and it was already happening that the people were like, "Ay, Gabo, you know, see that bench?" Gabo would come out every day and sit on the bench and talk to anybody who came by. So I'm looking at the bench like, dang, I should touch it. You know, Garcia Marquez's butt was here, you know. And someone tells me, "We think Mick Jagger lives in there now." So already this weird myth is going. Next door to Gabo's house is this beautiful, beautiful hotel that used to be a convent, a nunnery. So in one of the books, I think it's Love and Other Demons. Yeah, there's the story about a young girl who died and was put in a vault, and that the narrator is there when they open the vault, and volumes of her hair spill out of the vault. It kept growing. That really happened. He saw it. Next door to that house he bought, he was a reporter witnessing it. The vault is still there, and it's in the bar of the hotel, and it's closed off by a gate. So you enter into this comedically skullduggery scene where you go into the bar and you say to the bartender, "I'd like to see the vault." Oh, and he'll open the gate, and you go down steps. And there's the open vault. I have pictures of it. There's the open vault where she was lying. And then you come out and you walk around and someone takes you to a house where the love interest from Love in the Time of Cholera lived. And they'll point out the actual window and they say, "This is the chair Gabo used to sit on." And there's a scene where she walks across the plaza. He watched a girl walk across the plaza. And so at this point, you're all keyed up, right, with the fabulousness and the texture. And the bookstores, if you haven't been to Cartagena, they have wine bars. Every American bookstore should do this. You go in and the people selling the books are bartenders, and they have beer, micheladas, wine. Go in there, michelada. We sit down and people are just sitting there arguing about writing and poetry, right? It's perfect. Having a michelada, and this old man comes in and he sees us. There's a group of us talking about literature, and he comes and sits next to me. And he says in Spanish, "May I sit with you?" "Of course, sir." "Ay, gracias. You know, it's my birthday today." It's like, "Oh, I'm 80, blah, blah, blah." I said, "Well, happy birthday." And he looks at me and he says, "I'm Gabo's big brother or baby brother." I think it was baby brother. All of a sudden, magical realism happens.
Mm-hmm.
And he just sits back and starts telling us Garcia Marquez's life story and his childhood pranks. And we're drinking beer. And you're thinking, this is not possible. This entire visit is not believable, but there we go.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And there's a wonderful book. I hope you talk to him. Jay Perini did a book called Borges and Me. Borges and I think it's Borges and Me. Check that out. A memoir of being a young man in England, Ireland. And Borges is coming. And the host is too busy to deal with Borges. So he says, "I want you to take my car and drive him around."
Hmm.
He has this uproarious, insane Borgesian adventure with Borges when he doesn't really even know who Borges is. And they end up in a little country house where they have to sleep side by side in a tiny bed. And it's you find yourself entering into a different focus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. And so, you know, aside from being cork and good reads, these three books in this anthology are in some ways, if you're open to it, a kind of a portal to a more open response to the life you're leading. And I think it makes our lives more rich.
Mm, yeah. I totally agree. I've definitely, as I'm reading it, like I mentioned earlier, you know, seeing some, not seeing myself necessarily, but seeing situations or certain feelings and just moments in my life or things I'm trying to work through. They're coming, you know, I'm getting not answers necessarily, but different ways to think about life through reading him. And that's why I've been enjoying it. And it kind of leads me to it. And my next question is, you know, why should people read Rudolfo Anaya today?
Well, that's what we've been talking about this whole time.
That's right.
It's good stuff. You know, why should people read Le Guin? You know, why should people read me, for God's sake? I don't know why they are reading me, but I'm so thankful that they are. You know, I just think, I think certain readers, probably not everybody. I mean, you know, in my spare time, or I'm not trying to be Bodhisattva boy or something, I like hard, you know, hard-boiled detective novels, man. I love those. Yeah.
They're great.
And, Cindy, my beloved, is always reading some highfalutin literary novel, and I'm grinding away, you know, at the latest Michael Connelly novel or something.
Yeah.
And she mocks me. But there's something about those books that, to me, is magical realism. I don't know what it's like to be a hard-bitten, hard-drinking, melancholy dude with a pistol. It's kind of interesting to me. So it's good writing. I think it in some interesting ways has throwback vibes. You know, if you ever liked Willa Cather, if you ever liked Eudora Welty, those people are not up to the minute go New Yorkers, but they have told things that are profound and I think long lasting.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever liked Steinbeck, you know, if you any of those writers from that era, I think Rudy is an iteration of some of that vibe. I think it's good writing, and of course he's in some ways one of my fathers, so I want people to know him and respect him.
Yeah.
But if you have to read to get respect, it's homework and you won't like it. So just for the pleasures in the story, you should just
leave it. Yeah. Yeah. Read for reading's sake. That's
exactly.
Couldn't agree more. Exactly. Yeah.
At the end of the day, you know, you don't want, it's not like you're being forced to study a textbook because that kills any book.
Right. Yeah.
Read it for pleasure, for the hell of it. And you don't have to even get this anthology. There's a new paperback edition of Bless Me Ultima. Erica Sanchez wrote the intro. It brings it up to date for the new Latin-A culture.
Great. Yeah.
And there's a movie. There is a good Hollywood movie of it too.
Oh, cool. I'll have to finish that after the book so I can see how well
after the book, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're getting close to the end here. Was there anything else that you wanted to mention about Rudy or his life and yours together? Any final parting words of wisdom for us?
I just wish he was still here. You know, if you like the book he wrote, I believe it's called Love Song of the Old Man or Love Story of the Old Man. He had a wife that they were partners, the kind of marriage I ended up in, but you know, Pat, and she passed away in his arms. And oh, I think after she left, I think he was ready to go. Mm-hmm. And you see a certain tone, but that book is heartbreaking, mm-hmm. And beautiful. And he asked me to blurb it, which I didn't feel up to that task, but I did give it a blurb. And that's quite beautiful.
The full circle moment there.
it really was. Yeah. I was given the great blessing of feeling close circle with both Rudy and Ursula. When Ursula received the Oregon Award, basically for the greatest writer on the planet, I got to be the MC and I got to present it to her. So, and it was near the end. And now, just now, nobody knows this, but I was one of the judges for the first Ursula K. Le Guin Literary Award. We just convened yesterday. So, you know, those things, if you see the world in the way I think Rudy tried to show me to see the world, then you see a wonderful pattern that has a sense to it. It's just not something you could put on a chart, really.
You only can feel it, right?
Yeah, you can. It's seasons. Mm-hmm. Seasonal, you know. Tonight we're going to have, they think, a freeze and frost. Mm-hmm. Somebody knows that's coming. And you respond, oh yeah, okay, I'm going to save my flowers.
Take them in.
It's like that for me.
I like that. Yeah. Now I'm going to be thinking about that. I lost my sign up. That was a good thing to think about. That's also what I like about his work. Like, he's been giving me things to think about, way his, things his characters go through and how they deal with them and how they endure.
I think, and this may be the last thought, not necessarily about Rudy, but just in general, I think that especially how polarized we are right now, right? How everything is so fraught with so much poison and crap and resentment and paranoia. I don't like this. And I used to laugh at my parents talking about the good old days. Now the good old days were 1971. I think, man, Alice Cooper. But I think that being able to read across culture is a way, kind of like the thing, you were saying about Rudy talking about making your grandmother somebody else's grandmother. It's just a way for us to sit down and just see another human being. Mm-hmm. And Rudy has the insatiable need to slip a couple of chuckles here and there. And I've thought about this a long time. And one of my main writing rules, and I tell every single workshop this, is that laughter is the virus that infects us with humanity. And if you sit with somebody and laugh with them, it's almost impossible to walk away from the table and say, that person's a pig. And the ultimate, I think, outcome of that, you laugh together. In other words, if you feel together, later on, you're free to weep together too. It can be a profound ritual of transformation and unity. It's really cool. laughter is prayer if it's not evil, if it's not vicious.
Yeah, right. Important to every culture, right?
Like
every,
absolutely.
Every, you know, every human. Yeah.
That's why the Zen masters are so damn fun.
Yeah.
If you read the haiku of Esau, you blow your mind. You think, I'm going to go get a cup of coffee with this guy.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. Go ahead.
Wow. Well, thank you. Thank you, Luis, for,
thanks,
for
Nate.
This talk. Yeah, this was great. We laughed. So now we're good, right?
We're good. We must be brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. Okay. So, all right. Let's do this. We'll have, let's do a monthly podcast because we're good at this.
There you go. Yeah.
I enjoyed this a lot, man.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.